But they entered into negotiations. Now you have to ask yourself, to really understand how this exposes, what I mean, it just takes the thing off, just exposes what a bourgeois democracy is. You see, we Marxists, we're very dogmatic and stuff, and we believe that behind bourgeois democracy is a small ruling class, a minority that really rules society, that's got the power. Now in France, the overwhelming majority voted for some things, and then they entered negotiations. Who was negotiating? Who was negotiating with the French people? Because they were on strike. It was this little ruling minority. They held control. The police followed their orders. They never tested it, but the army, theoretically, most certainly the officers followed their order. They had control of all the governmental buildings. And it turned out they were the government. By God, just what Marx said. And they negotiated with the people of France, supposedly democracy. In fact, De Gaulle got on TV and said, I am dissolving parliament and holding an election in the future to save us from a violent, dictatorial rule. That is, the majority might take power. You see, to the bourgeoisie, that is tyranny. Because if they can't rule, then anybody else ruling is tyranny. So if the majority should rule, that to him is tyranny. So the ruling class is exactly what they mean by a communist dictatorship, that they should lose power and the majority should rule. It's exactly what De Gaulle means. Why, he assumed all power. He said, we may not even hold those elections. A good politician doesn't say it until he has to. It goes to show De Gaulle's getting old. But he wanted to make it clear that he meant it. You see, he was saying to the bourgeoisie of France that was ready to, move out again, move to England or Algeria or somewhere, back to Germany, Of course, there were no planes and stuff, so the situation was really bad. He wanted to assure them that he really meant it. So if you go back and read those speeches, now they're forgetting about it because the thing didn't develop the way they thought it might, you see. And don't kid yourself, this was also... they had one line, I'm sure, the hot line straight to the White House, working this thing out, and who was ready to do what in case of what. He got up there and in effect said, we may not even have these elections, and I will rule. Meaning, I representing this tiny minority, we aren't surrendering. Now, Marx also said that they don't surrender, you see. Now, you ask yourself, if the workers are the majority, they have their organizations, by the way, democratically elected, that's about that. They elect their delegates and everything in the unions. They have their political parties they support and so forth. They have all these organizations set up. They were setting up in some areas committees in the factory strike committees. The students had taken over the university, elected. Now, how come De Gaulle gets into you? I mean, why didn't one of the workers elect their representatives, have one of them get on TV, put De Gaulle under house arrest, to be tried for any one of 2,892 crimes that he's committed in violation of the law, shooting Algerians and all types of things like that. Just put him house arrest. Get on TV and say, the majority have clearly voted, the demands will be met. There are some people who are trying to set up a dictatorship of a minority against the majority. We're going to assure the majority going to rule, there's going to be elections, we're going to set up a workers' councils, and from now on the majority have indicated the workers can control the factory, from now on they control the factory, and those people that used to own factories, you can apply for work, and that we guarantee them work. We're going to make sure that, so forth, the workers would have marched to the barracks. Listen, just think it out, how close France was to a socialist revolution. Then I'm going to explain why it didn't happen. The police are built to fight every day against the population, their own population, not the army. French army is made up of conscripts, just like draftees, just like American army. They don't even have as many volunteers. It's a conscript army. It is made up of workers' sons, farmers' sons. Now, don't forget, France is on strike. Their families are on strike. Their family writing them letters about how they're holding out, how they're running out of food and so forth. You can't call on them to shoot those strikers. If the workers had gone to those barracks and said, okay, you guys, come on out and join us in demonstrations, they would have come. Elect your own committee. Send your representatives. Give us the guns. The police said to the government in those critical moments they would not fight the workers. That if they were sent against workers, they wouldn't. You know why? Not because the police all of a sudden discovered that they should be nice. They just figured out that they'd have the living daylights kicked out of them. And those who figure that type of thing sometimes lose, especially people who have a bully's mentality like these police do, they all of a sudden they discover they're not so anxious, you see, when they know they're going to be outnumbered and trounced. In fact, they threatened to go on strike too. And if the workers had marched into the police stations to disarm those police, they would have declared a strike. I'll give you odds to save their necks. Then when they got on TV, the workers' representative could have put not only De Gaulle under house arrest, he could have ordered the army units to immediately arm all the factory units and so forth to make sure that no minority can overthrow the people, arm the people, defend their own rights, and hold it to democratically election, allowing even the bourgeoisie can run on the program that the factories will be turned back over to them so they can be millionaires again and not have to work for a living. They can run under that program. We'll see how many votes they get. You see. Now, why didn't it happen? Well, to understand the events of France, the meeting, that's what you've got to study carefully. Because it's going to happen, but it's going to take a little while. To get the exact historic parallel, to get the closest exact historic parallel to that is Petrograd, February 1917, when the workers did the exact same thing, except they actually went out and took the guns from the army, everything I've said, except when the guy got on TV, there was no TV in those days, you know, but went to the parliament, the socialists. What they did do was not get up and announce that it's all over. The socialists that went to the parliament, at that time called the Duma in Russia, was look around for guys like De Gaulle, because they'd all gone hiding. See, we're knocking on the door. Is there anybody in here? Anybody to rule Russia? And they found six or seven of them hiding in a room. They said, hey, my God, Jesus, we've taken power, and we're socialists, and our theory explains to us, and we're not interested in that. Workers' control. See, they're all from the middle class, these socialists. They said to the guys, look, first there's feudalism, then there's capitalism, and there's socialism. Now, we've had feudalism in Russia, now we've got to go to capitalism. It's terrible that accidents happen historically, the workers have taken power, but you're capitalist, come and take power. See? So they dug up Prince Lvov, he became the head of the government, and mainly they dug up this Kerensky, who was sort of like De Gaulle, you know, he discovered, I'm going to save Russia and the whole thing. Very similar to that, in the fact that the workers actually moved and had the power for a moment, these socialists, certain leaders of the workers, who aren't themselves workers, but who the workers have trust in, because of historic reasons, put the power in somebody else's hands. Now, let's look at France. France is a certain very close parallel to this. Trade union bureaucrats have privileges. Like all bureaucrats, they have developed a mentality over the years and an apparatus and organization to maintain those privileges, which is fundamentally hostile to, as basically hostile as the AFL-CIO bureaucracy in this country, to seeing the workers rise up, arm, take power, because that would destroy their privileges. Not only that, but they don't feel comfortable with rank-and-file workers. They're never around them to begin with. They feel much more comfortable in literary circles, in the middle class, or right down with De Gaulle. In fact, one of the greatest moments for any American trade union bureaucrat is the day he's invited into the White House, allowed to have a cup of coffee, and then told to go out the back door. That's the highest point in his life, his dream, you see. To be accepted with it so he can, you know, sit down and talk to the Rockefellers and be treated like one of the gang, you see. That's what they dream. Well, the Communist Party is no different in France. It's got a record 1 mile long of doing this since the beginnings of the 30s, since the 34, 35 period. I told you about how they voted for sending the troops to Vietnam. Let me just tell you a few little incidents along the road so that, you know, I'll give you more empirical proof if you want, but just to give you a feeling how deep this conservative aspect of the Communist Party is in France. After the French re-entered Vietnam, they had a problem. They had made a deal with Ho Chi Minh, and they'd been able to get their troops into Haiphong. And they got the supplies ready and everything to go to war, to try to take over Vietnam again, but they needed, they were ready to do it, and they wanted a pretext. So they found a pretext, and the general wired from Haiphong, now what do I do? And he was given the orders, bomb the Vietnamese section. So under General Leclerc's orders, the Haiphong Vietnamese section was bombed by the and shelled by the French, killing 6,000 Vietnamese. After this happened, they had a vote of confidence in General Leclerc, honoring him and congratulating him for the work he had done in the parliament in France, of which 182 communist deputies voted for it. The whole time that the Algerians were fighting for their independence, the Communist Party referred to them in the 1945 period as fascists, who must be crushed, supported the bombing of Madagascar, where 80,000 casualties were suffered, the bombings of Algeria. The French Communist Party in 1956, as I said before, voted for the special powers for the French to fight against the Algerians. And their record is like one continuous line. Now look at their record when these strikes started. What's the first thing they did? First thing they did is when the students started demonstrating is they called them hooligans and adventurers and tried to appeal into anti-German racist prejudice against Danny the Red. Referred to him the German. The right-wingers called him the German Jew. You see. Call them these students adventurers, tell everybody to keep away from them. When it became clear that the overwhelming mass, the sentiment of the country was for these students, the Communist Party couldn't any longer maintain this position because they lose their ranks, so they shifted a little bit. They said, yeah, the students got a pretty bad deal there, so we'll have to be for them and so forth, but keep away from them. Then the workers took the factory. They didn't tell them to take the factories. They didn't tell them to strike. It happened completely out of their control. But once it happened, what were they going to say? So it's already there. The Communist Party comes out and says, strike. Take the factories. You see, to keep control over the goddamn thing. Now, what the ruling class was trying to judge was, can the Communist Party deliver? Can it maintain control? You see. Then the students started marching to the workers, like they marched on the Renault factory to talk to them. That is what threw the panic into those trade union bureaucrats. Suppose they talk to the workers about socialist revolution, how to take power and all that stuff, and that starts getting common. Workers start having joint meetings with students. They start leafleting them. So the first thing they ordered, and they have an apparatus, the French Communist Party. They have a defense, what they call defense guards, you know, workers' guards, which they use for patrol, you know, for like when they go on demonstrations, being the monitors. Those guards, those monitors, have never fought the police. But they have fought other workers throughout the last 20 years, including students. So they send these guards to the gates to meet the workers and told them they can't come in. Workers, we don't want to mess with you guys. If you guys came in here, the police might attack us, you know. Us poor little workers. There's only 30,000 of us in this Renault plant. And you guys bring fire, and you come in here, and those goddamn cops will come all the way over from Paris and attack us, you see. And one of the things that's really scared the living daylights out of them was the fact that young workers started going out with the student demonstration, siding with the students as opposed to the Communist Party. Then they went and negotiated with the Gaulle's government. Now, you've got to understand what that means. Communist Party, the strongest representative for the workers, like in Russia at that point, it was the Mensheviks and the Social Revolutionaries, goes and gives legitimacy to de Gaulle's government, which has no base, nobody supporting anymore of any consequence. Once they negotiate, it's in effect saying to workers, this is still the government. You're not the government. And they raise the slogan that what we should do now is change the ratios in parliament. That was their big political demand. They got the guts, they got up all their courage and said, in effect, to the ruling class, things get really rough, we'll run the government for you. You got to understand. Thorez became vice president of France. Thorez was the head of the Communist Party at the end of the Civil War. He became vice president of France the last time they had a major crisis, in 1944 to 46, in order to disarm the workers. In effect, what Duclos was saying to the French ruling class was, you need us again, we'll do it again, because that way we keep our privilege, you understand. But their ability to do that depends on their having control over the working class, you see. Now, the Socialist Party plays the same basic role, except they're not the major force anymore. They used to be in the 1936-38 period. The workers learned from that experience that the Socialist Party is worthless, so they quit it, and they started voting communist. The basic heavy industry, the Renault workers, those types are very strong basis of the control of the Communist Party. They switched over to the communist. About a 2-to-1, as opposed to the socialists. And now, they're beginning another historic switch. Just like the working class of Petrograd and Moscow switched from the social revolutionaries and the Mensheviks to the Bolsheviks from February to October, the experience they've just gone through. The workers have tested the Communist Party, what can produce. Now there's a left opposition saying that they're no good, that they're rotten, based on the JCR and some workers in some factories, like the Renault plants and some others, where there's revolutionary communists. They're like the Bolsheviks. They're saying, this doesn't work, we should have taken power. Just like the Bolsheviks said, you should never have handed the power over to anybody in February, the Soviets should have taken power. The democratically elected council of workers and farmers and so forth. The revolutionary socialists in France right now are saying, You should have set up councils in every factory in the universities, and we should have taken power. So now you begin the shift as more and more workers begin to move over away from the Communist Party to the Revolutionary Socialists. That's the next stage. For that, we'll have to go through a big period. I know. So all right, let me end so we get to questions, and I'll take up some of the other things I wanted to say during the question. I'll slip it into questions. Okay. Let me then just say this. Okay, that's the stage we're at right now. The thing with tremendous upswing, they didn't get anywhere. The government now is playing it both ways, the ruling class. One is threatened that you'll really come down, though they're scared as hell to make a test of strength, and at the same time give some concessions. They did that in 1936. You see, even if for a little while companies run at a loss, get them back in the factories, you see. Get things working, get them demoralized, then we can work out some political deals, get some illusions about something else, get, you know, get organized, get time. Find out which units are reliable. Maybe recruit some more paratroopers, put a little money into some fascist gangs we haven't got any organized, you see. Play for time. That's their first attitude. So it's both threatened that you're going to use military force, which immediately sent the Communist Party running. The minute they said, imagine, we're going to hold elections again. That was it. That's a big promise. You're going to hold elections again. A tiny little minority, it's got no power, says it's going to hold elections again, and in return the Communist Party says, oh great, we can participate in those elections, and they say, everybody go back to work, you see. That's the stage it's at. Now, I want to say two other things, just end to end. But there are some secondary lessons for Americans from this thing that are fantastic when you stop and think about it. You know, everybody, except for very small groups, in percentage-wise, most certainly in the population, like the Socialist Workers' Party and the Unsocialist Alliance, in the United States, most radicals believed that you were not going to, that it was, if they didn't believe it, they at least had deep sympathy for the concept that Marcuse had raised, that because of the fantastic prosperity in the advanced industrial countries, the type of worker struggles that we saw in the 19th century and so forth were over, that we saw during the Depression, and maybe an exceptional case here and there during the end of the Second World War, that that thing had been solved. The advanced workers weren't going to make socialist revolutions like that anymore. It was going to come some other way. It was going to come in the colonial world. Everybody agrees that socialist revolutions can happen in the colonial world, but they can't happen in the advanced countries. Well, this all of a sudden shatters that, if you stop and think about it, if you analyze it. It shows that even with a slight decline in the standard of living, the actual objective conditions where you could conceivably take state power can arise. It doesn't even have to be a big depression or mammoth inflation, with the population basically completely employed, living at a qualitatively higher standard of living than any colonial country, even than the countries bordering it, like Italy, Spain, and Greece. Is Greece border France? I don't think so. Yugoslavia? No, that's, I don't want to say. Germany, I'm not sure which way it goes. England, I think they got a higher standard of living. Switzerland, they got a higher. Thank you. The other thing is that notice that the revolution that was taking place in the colonial world, everybody said, we the socialists have said there's three parts to what's happening in the world today. There's a revolution within the Soviet Union and the others to get political democracy, not to change the planned economy, but to get political democracy. There's the revolution of the advanced countries, the revolution of the colonial countries. And we said, as a crisis on a world scale that is now beginning to deepen of capitalism continues, these three processes interrelate and they give impetus to all three. As the colonial revolution advances, the danger of a revolution will increase more and more in the advanced countries. And this will give an impetus to struggle for more democracy in the Soviet bloc. Now notice what has happened. You have Czechoslovakia, the student demonstrations in Poland. You have this beginning to develop. You have the rising of France. And at the same time, you have the continued expansion of the colonial revolution. Because one thing that was lost sight of is during this whole thing is the Viet Cong is trying to take Saigon. Huh? And what we're entering now in France will have deep repercussions throughout all Europe. You see, where people before were pragmatic, you know, were like American SDS type oriented, you gotta, like SDS, you know, when it was first founded, began with you have to infiltrate the power structure. And they changed a little bit, but they were always pragmatic, like the support of Johnson in 1964, and it was always like, you know, just looking at everything, Marxism was wrong, you don't have a long range perspective where the American working class is gonna move, that's ruled out and stuff like that, and you have to build a socialist movement. Well, what does France do to all these theories? What will it mean for the youth in all of Europe and France and Italy and Germany? What type of groups are they going to join now? What's their perspective? When they see that it was the power was right around the corner. If they could win the sympathy of the workers, and like in France, with this experience in the next 6 months, it's conceivable that there'll be a socialist revolution. Let me make one last prediction. If there is, the best moment for it was lost. Because now the bourgeoisie is a hell of a lot more prepared, and that means that France will probably have to go through a period of civil war before they take power. Okay. Let's first deal with this question about giving concessions. See, the American ruling class is much better off economically than the French. Tremendous amount, much more resources, much more wealth. You just stop and think of the comparison. The French budget, war budget, armaments budget in 64 was $1.8 billion. But the Americans with, what, 50, 60 billion, and it's now 70 billion, is spending $30 billion a year in Vietnam. It just makes France look like nothing. Now, it is true that insofar as the United States can continue to give higher pay, like every time the workers demand something, be able to give concessions, it tends to have the general impact of placating and maintaining the workers apolitical. Now, you've got to remember one very important aspect of this. One is that that is what keeps them apolitical. It's nothing ingrown, basic, or definitive, or anything. And it has a different side to it. See, you sell your future when you use that technique. If you ever want to be a member of a ruling class and oppress another class, it is always better to smash them really good, you see, and try to keep them smashed. Because once you try to win them through concessions and concessions, that's terrific. That's the best way. Things are calm, collected, and so on. But when you can't deliver those concessions, that class has gotten psychologically used to winning, and everything else, like the American working class, has never been defeated. It has never known a dictatorship. It believes it has the right to free speech, to unions, to everything, and it believes that so deeply, you see, that the day you can't give those concessions, you see, the radicalization in this country will make the radicalization in France look like nothing. Let me finish. The question is, are you going to have a change in the economic situation? Now, let me tell you something. Let me just make the argument. This is the crucial argument. This is the crucial question of the whole history of the world. Will the American mass working people intervene in history on the side of all those people who are trying to make revolutionary change? And that, most people agree, depend on whether the American economy can continue its upward swing. Okay, now let me just tell you this. We hold that the economic problems that France is having are nothing compared to what we are about to face in the next period of history in the United States. We don't set any time limit, but let me explain why. Just look at it this way. Let me show you, give you two proofs, but let me give you first the empirical and then the theoretical one. Take the empirical proof.
I'm well aware of the financial crisis.
No, not financial, not gold and that type of stuff. Let me just point out an empirical proof, okay? The United States has been at its maximum prosperity in its whole history, the highest point of capitalism in world history, in the last 20 years. And it hasn't been able to wipe out poverty even within its boundaries, while maintaining the whole capitalist world as a world scale in a point where even huge sections of it are declining during the prosperity. For instance, actual food consumption per person in Latin America has dropped since the end of the Second World War. You see, so that you're being with a system that is a worldwide system, and at its epicenter here, it is not able to solve the problems of the mass. During its highest point, in fact, has not been able to solve the basic problems within its own boundaries. Take the housing question. Slums have existed all along. They're growing. It can't even solve that. Now, that's at its high point, at its max, when it has expanded into all the markets, when it has taken markets from everybody, when it's making the highest rate of profit it has ever made in its history. It can't maintain full employment. It has even whites living. It gave figures of something like millions are going hungry in the United States. So you have to make this empirical point. At its best, it didn't begin to expand. Now what your theory would have to hold is the following. That it is about to go into a terrific change. That what the prosperity we have seen is nothing compared to what's about to happen. That the United States is about to begin to expand in an economic outburst that is unparalleled, the system will start working, begin to solve these problems. Otherwise, the following two things are going to happen. The gradual process of social revolution throughout the world will have an ideological huge impact on the United States, which will change it, and which will change its economy, Because if the United States loses its markets all over the world through socialist revolutions, it will destroy the American economy. Or the other is going to happen. It can't maintain the high standard of living anymore. Now, let me just give you a point of fact. Isn't it true that the reason the ruling class in the United States is starting to think about de-escalating in Vietnam? Because they're starting to get inflation. For the last 2 years, the standard of living of the American workers has not gone up. In other words, right at this point when we're talking, when the French are almost coming to power and would immediately create a crisis in all Europe and be disastrous for the American economy, you have a situation where the American ruling class can't even give higher pay right now and has to think about de-escalating in the colonial revolution, where it's fighting only one tiny country of 17 million when there's still 1.5 billion people in the colonial world, you see. So to give the perspective that the United States is going to maintain this prosperity and the workers are not going to move, you have to move another notch. You have to say, well, all right, there'll be times when the standard of living is going to drop in the United States and stuff like that, but the American workers are different from the French workers. They're just not political like that, you see. They're not going to move like that. Then you have to develop a thesis that if you carry it to its logical conclusions, American workers aren't like workers everywhere else in the world. They're not the same species. That's all. So, all right, I'll let you ask another. Okay, go ahead. Oh, that's all right. That's good.
One thing that there is unique in France, of course, you do have the power structure. You have a group of capitalists who do control the industry. They are concerned with perpetuating their own power. However, the American capitalist is a little shrewder. They're more concerned with perpetuating the corporation.
Yeah, okay, now, that's the second part of your question. Let me answer
that. They may sacrifice their own power. They may grant the workers some power.
Yeah, let me answer that part of your question.
This will forestall the revolution.
Right, let me answer that question. That is simply unadulterated bull. The American capitalists have been concentrating capital unparalleled. They make the French look like they've shared the capital with everybody compared to the way it's concentrated in this country. That business about everybody else's stock. Let me tell you.
Yeah, well, I know that's an illusion.
Not an illusion. That is the biggest myth. Look, let me explain to you. I start a company, okay? And I own $1 million, and I got a nice company going. And then I'm making 10%. And God damn it, there's a market opened up, and I just don't have another $1 million to build another whole factory and get that market and make 10%. So I walk up to you, and you're a worker, a nice, stupid, dumb American worker, and I say, I want you to share. This is a people's capitalism. 1 million of you give me $1, and I'll give you all the stock, and I'll give you 5% on it. Well, sure, they get somebody else's money. You got $1 million, you build yourself another factory, you run it at 10%, you take 5%, you share 5% to other people, you say. So in other words, what the capitalists do through the stock business is they try to borrow from the working class to build up their capital even greater, you see. And that section that the workers give through like owning stocks is an insignificant portion, 2-3% of the capital accumulated in this country, and that percentage is declining steadily. In fact, you'll find that the average family in the United States at the high points of prosperity are not with money in the bank, with stock saved up. They are, in fact, at this very moment, $60 billion in debt. Yep. So that if someone said to the American workers, pay, the whole economy collapses. Because the money doesn't exist.
They're trying to reach the middle class.
Yes, now you got it.
Or middle class standards.
Well, now, that's another example. That's a ideological propaganda, this business about middle class. You see, middle class, what they mean by middle class is that you have a slightly higher standard of living than people had in the 1930s. You've got your own house and your car, in which you're paying more. That's called middle class. See, it's very tricky wording, because middle class has a real meaning, which they try to imply through this, and that is you're no longer a worker.
Yeah.
90% of American people are working class. It's the highest country in the world in concentration of workers. France has 2 million farmers out of 50 million people. The United States has no such thing.
Skilled labor is no longer working, man.
That's what they try to tell them. It's like American students. They tell them, you're not
a profession.
That's right. A plumber's a profession.
Yeah, right.
And take students. Students is the extreme case. They tell students you're middle class, you see. And a student says, yeah, I'm not a worker. That's right, I'm middle class, you see. And he's out there, you know, going out and going for interviews for jobs, saying to himself, I'm middle class. I'm not a worker. And he's a programmer, or he works in a social worker, you know, something like that. And he keeps saying to himself, I'm middle class. You know, I'm not a worker. See, regardless of what people think they are, there is an objective reality. See, I mean, a guy who's in an insane asylum thinks he's Napoleon, he still is Napoleon. And we sort of live in a communal insane asylum where you know, millions upon millions of people say, I'm not a worker, as they punch in their car. But you see, when that type of thing works, and that type of propaganda, and that type of mythology can be created only under conditions of where you have a gradual rising standard of living, where people, see, deep inside they don't even believe it. What it is that they set up a value scheme where you're looked up to if you're not a worker. They don't realize that what it is a inverted acceptance of the capitalist concept that the rich are superior, more intelligent, better, and poor people are generally bad. It's another aspect to like racist prejudice. See, basically people prejudice against black people because they're poor. If black people were richer in this society, you see, it'd be awful hard to whip up the type of racial prejudice. It's all aspect. You see, people, if a rich guy walks into the room, you know, and he's got millions of dollars, everybody's like, oh, you see. And workers accept the ideology. They take the values from their ruling class, and they imitate them, you see. Now, when their standard of living begins to drop, yeah, the American flag, patriotism is a perfect example of exactly that type of thing. See, but that breaks down under crises. Now, I didn't even mention, for instance, the crisis of the youth. The whole American youth are going through a crisis, a moral crisis, most certainly, and the war in Vietnam is creating a political crisis. And this is the next generation, you say. And this is under the periods of maximum prosperity. So that I think that if you really look at it, what you have to say, you see this, look, let me give you one other sign to American workers. America is like extremists. It's going to be an extreme thing. It's been the extreme gainer of capitalism, the highest standard of living, the most privileges, you say, where people have the deepest illusions about bourgeois democracy. Because of that extreme, when they radicalize, it will also be, and this is what people can't understand the dialectic, but they'll also be one of the most extreme. See, the way to understand it is this. The day the standard of living really begins to drop in this country, the first real turn where they have to cut the pay 2, 3, 4, 5%, the workers in this country won't think twice, just won't think twice of like not only taking over their factory like they did in 1937, 1,000 American factories, the workers sat in, took them over, starting with the Flint in November something or other, 1936. They'll walk into City Hall. You send the cops down to fight the workers, American workers? Yeah, grab a stick and kill a cop in 10 seconds. This cops are supposed to be out there chasing black people and criminals. That right? That's supposed to be going out and hitting white people? Yeah, that's how dumb American workers are, you see. That's been told them by the society. And they're all armed to the teeth. Isn't that the case? No, it's not like France, you know. Some communists will come along and say, go armed. They say, what are you talking about? We're already armed. And, you know, and just like in France, the revolution is sparked like that over conditions that developed. It's not that, like, everybody in the United States is going to start buying capital and start reading and they're going to become socialists and then vote for socialism. It's going to be that they're going to go through direct experiences, like the war in Vietnam. Like, for instance, they'll elect McCarthy president, and this probably isn't going to happen, but I'm just giving you a for instance. Elect McCarthy president, he doesn't end the war. That's like, you know, a little shocker. Maybe he escalates, invades some other country. That's no problem. Actually, no problem at all for McCarthy to do that. He just finds a pretext. That's easily done enough. Sure, okay. So, you know, these type of shocks of experiences, like they'll first vote in Democrats. That won't work. So say, hey, these Democrats and Republicans are no good. Let's have our own party. They set up a Labor Party. They elect those in. And they don't change the system, and they can't solve the problems either. See, meanwhile, a left wing, a socialist, begins to develop. Say. Now, in the United States, we don't have the problem of like a mass communist party, the workers have illusions. The tendency will be to break from the Democratic Party and possibly go all the way over to very advanced ideas. Because once they break, they're open to all ideas. And right now, it just happens to be a fact that there are more revolutionary socialists in the United States than there are reformist socialists, because it's pretty hard to be a socialist to begin with. So that tends to give the advantage to the more revolutionary. And that's, by the way, the whole key to the next future of the United States. If we can build a YSA, like the German SDS, like the French JCR, thousands and thousands and thousands, given even the slightest turn, we can turn to that working class and start recruiting young workers all over the goddamn place. And they won't, workers won't care about the word socialist, communism, all that, you know, like that business about the flag and the communism is terrible. They just drop that, like, they just, you come in and say, communism, oh, good. They, workers don't begin to understand what do you mean communism. Everybody says it's bad, so you say it's bad. It's like the devil's bad, yeah, the devil's bad. You see. But if God gave you a pay cut, they'd start saying, what's that? Where's the and that's the way they are. You see? majority of the workers in France are Catholics. They're Catholics. They believe that God says that communism is the devil. We're both communists. See, that won't slow them up. Some of them, you know, it might somewhat, but generally it tends to, like, they over it. And then there's the other case, the young kids who will all of a sudden wake up. It's like, look at young black kids today. Huh? You go back 30 years when the workers were fighting in this country, and black people were primarily farmer hands in the South, and you talk to one, take an interview, the concepts, the ideas, right? Now you take a young kid in the ghetto and ask him what his concepts and ideas of America are. You know, there's some big changes taking place. And these changes in ideas, and like among young people, students, don't forget that in the United States, over 50% of the kids graduated high school and enter college. So when you're talking about the student community, you're talking about working class people. Kids who come from working class homes who are going to be workers, no matter what they think. And they're radicalizing, they're alienated. In other words, you have all the symptoms of a beginning thing here. And even in comparing to the French workers, the American working class, this division between Meany and Ruther is like, you know, just like a tiny little dawn example of the type of rifts that are beginning already within the working class of demanding a little more, wanting the bureaucracy to fight more. Very, very early. Nobody's saying that the American workers are radical, that you can go talk to them about socialism yet. But the 2 years that we've had of the inflation because of the war has already created a nervousness in the American working class. So that, you know, I answer these questions so long, but let me say one last thing. If the majority of the people believed that a social revolution was necessary, or even that it was possible and good, it would happen. You have to always presuppose in every society that the majority at that moment don't believe it's possible, nor that it's desirable, you say. So the fact that the American workers don't think that socialism is good and so forth, it's just an empirical fact that has to be for capitalism to continue in this country, you say. In fact, they won't think that except for, like, all of a sudden in a moment, like right now the French workers at this moment might say, Jesus, it's actually possible for us to take power, you say. And that type of concept, that will come, like, out of mass struggles. And then the question will be posed in this country like it is in France. Is there a leadership? Is there an organization in the leadership that's won the workers through the process before these things have come to pass that can then show the way, win over the working class, and actually take the immediate steps to take power? And that's what we're doing. I mean, you know, this is like, there's another name for the Socialist Workers' Party could be, you know, Committee for the Taking of State Power by the Working Class in the United States. I mean, that's the purpose. And it'll never be popular and big until the moment comes when that can actually be done. I mean, see, what he has to do now is this. He's trying to mobilize all the reactionary forces in the country, try to unify them. That's the only role he can play, you see. That's when he got tough, he did that. That's why he was able to pull 200,000, 300,000 people in the streets. Now, the one thing that will unite them, the bourgeoisie, in all its factions, is stop the workers, which takes the form of, in propaganda, communist totalitarianism. Also, it's to make a mammoth now campaign to say there's a minority trying to take power who want to do what's happened in Russia with a tyranny and all that. Play on every backwardness they can find in the population. Try to scare the farmers and so forth away from it. This will mean they'll take your farms away. You see, in other words, he wants to put the specter right off the bat of a workers' revolution in the worst possible terms he can, as opposed to capitalism in its propaganda best possible form, democracy and freedom and so forth. And that's also to prepare the psychology of the whole country for possible civil war. You see, in the elections before this, his policy was to appeal to the French people as the man who was both against the United States and against the Soviet Union. You see. He was the man that represented French independence. There was going to be a colony to no one. The communists would not take power and make it a colony to Russia. The American monopolies wouldn't take over and make France. He was independent, you see. Now he just shifts the whole propaganda stance to being the free world democracy against communist totalitarianism. He's got to try to draw the line that way and try to force, for instance, the Socialist Party away from the Communist Party. By the way, let me say something about that business. The ruling class does not like the fact the Communist Party has any influence over the workers. They know that they can use them, and they'll use them. But they would prefer to smash the whole Communist Party of France and have real reactionaries run the union. They would really like fascism, you see. so that if the Communist Party succeeds, let's say for the next 3 years, in continuously stopping the revolution, and the workers get completely demoralized, and a fascist regime triumphs in France, they won't congratulate the communists and shake hands with them, they'll execute them, you see. In other words, they'll be their own grave diggers. That's one way to look at it is this way, to give to, you can really understand what I mean is this. Imagine a trade union bureaucrat who is so bureaucratic and presses down so much on the workers that the union gets destroyed. He loses his privileges. You see, and when the question is posed, like it is today in France, all power for the ruling class or all power for the workers, there's no compromise. Because there's no stability until one destroys the fighting capacity of the other. And what's the fighting capacity of the workers? Their unions, their basic organizations. Until those are tamed. And how can they be tamed when an organization like the Communist Party, which the ruling class doesn't control directly, they can never be sure it can be tamed, and which left currents develop. Don't forget the Communist Party is not a monolithic thing. There are all types of left wing. In fact, in the papers they said even on their central committee, there were rebels starting to appear in the Communist Party, the younger members, wanting a more radical policy. Imagine the young Communist Party member worker, what must be going through his mind. How many of them are going to start? So the whole goddamn Communist Party apparatus is not a secure way to rule. So that you can expect that they want a mammoth campaign against the Communist Party and try to force every other political tendency and everything to have to choose between extremes. And they hope on that basis to see, especially at a parliamentary level, to be able to maintain their majority. Yes?
I'd like to ask, was there any correlation in France with the Gestapo type intervention that we have with revolutionary activities in the United States? And if so, how did they come?
Give me an example. What do you mean, like what we have in the United States?
Coming in, busting up the Panthers, trying to put down the Red Guards.
Right, yeah. Well, CIA is obviously in France and functioning in France, and now I'm sure that their budget for France has gone astronomically up, and that they're mobilizing lots and lots of people. But you got to understand that what happens to the Panthers and what happens to us here is partially because they're able to get away with it. So you got to realize that in France, after May 10th and 11th, when the workers came out, you could not get away with it anymore. See, like, they have attacked the students several times in, like, test projects to see whether the workers respond. You got to remember that if the police came to, like, get the kids out of San Francisco State, meant an immediate general strike, the police would not go to San Francisco State. You got to remember what happened. After this big battle, they arrested students. I don't know, 1,000 students, some odd huge figure. The government released them and dropped all charges. Now, why? They didn't violate laws? You realize every sit-in was a violation of the law. They even locked up personnel. That's kidnapping. Death penalty in the United States and life in France. That's kidnapping. You think they're bringing charge against one worker? They dare? You see, laws and so-called law and order is only if you got the force to do it. And the ruling class can completely forget about its laws. There's laws now in the books, you can't strike here, you can't strike there. There's laws covering just about everything so no worker could strike. Well, strikes will happen, you see. So they can't test that law. Or they arrest all the strikers. See, so that what they do in this country and what you can do in that type of situation is totally different. Now, the government is very intelligent. The ruling class, they'll probe. They'll try, like maybe arrest one student and watch the reaction. There is no reaction. Keep at it. They'll escalate. See, if the workers get demoralized and they don't fight back, they'll escalate. And the people who've been the most daring, the most courageous, like the JCRs, they would face a fantastic repression, you see. They'll try to behead the most conscious elements. And they will try to do it with the help of the Communist Party. You see, what do they need? They need the Communist Party to make statements like, these are Trotskyite fascists who are disruptors of the labor movement. These are troublemakers who are against France.
Don't they call it social practice?
No, not anymore. And, you know, something like that. And so the average worker gets all confused. Well, there's his leader, you see. The question is, which side do the workers go on? They'll use anything. They'll have Communist Party. They'll put a Communist Party minister in charge of education maybe, who will do the arresting, you see. That's what they did in 45 and 46. So that we can expect all types of things to happen. But the key to it, the key, is can this new vanguard, the JCR, and the student revolution, the equivalent to the young socialists there in France, is now becoming quite large and winning all types of young workers, can they go to the young workers? And as each one of these conflicts come, increase their influence. So every time the government tries to repress it, just deepens their influence and lays the groundwork for the next mass upsurge. All of a sudden, you'll see committees pop up where they're electing, in every goddamn factory, they're electing a JCR or the equivalent in their worker organizations. like the International Communist Party or the Communist Union, electing these representatives to represent them, and they call a National Workers' Council and put De Gaulle under house arrest. See, which variant is going to take place? It's very hard to predict now. But that's why we say the thing is in motion now. It's got to have one settlement or another. It'll either move way to the right, the ruling class will win, or through experiences, the working class is going to develop a revolutionary wing and take power.
I want to cite an isolated case. When the co-workers, the United Co-Workers Union, John L. Lewis, made demands, the capitalists in control realized that to give them what they really wanted would take the profits away from mining coal. So what they did essentially was, okay, yes, we'll give you a concession, but no new members can be joining your unions. So we'll give you what you want, but as long as nobody joins your unions. So then, under this little fraud, they automated, and they just waited for the union members to die out. Now, I see right now where the assembly line technique is dying out in America. They realize that to make concessions to the workers is going to, you know, drain their capital. And they'd rather put it to better use, which would be to automate and to, you know, to introduce cybernetics. Now, do you see this as a threat to the workers?
Yeah, let me explain.
I mean, an immediate threat.
Yes, I understand. Let me explain. You see, what? See, that's where this is a very important point that you've raised. See, what has happened is this: the trade union bureaucracy in this country have taken the policy, good conditions for fewer workers, as the policy of each specific trade union, like the miners. They got smaller, smaller, steel workers the same, smaller and smaller, but higher and higher pay for the fewer that are left in order to make that one industry. They fight at one industry level. Then the workers become exploited. It's tough, you know, for them. And the new industry, making the automated machinery, they're ununionized, many of them. Okay. But the key thing to understand about France is that the working class didn't move in component parts. It moved as a whole class. See, you got to understand that. When one union strikes, like a factory over here strikes, the capitalist politician gets on TV and says, there are strikers, there's management, and there's the public. And the public is getting tired of the strike. You see, like if the subway strike or something like that, you see. And they play this. Now we're sending in a neutral mediator who represents the public, you see. But when the class is a class strikes, whole class, then this business of privileges to a minority and all that all breaks down. Because, you see, in France, they said the public, they said it because they're so, you know, it's like a rat you train to go through the maze, you know, and you put it in and it goes through the maze. That's American reporters. The public is getting tired of the strike now in France. I saw them saying, I almost fell off my chair. What public? They're all on strike. What? 40 million people out of a country, 50 million on strike. He says, the public, who's that? Two or three guys walking down the street? They're the public, they say. So that when they strike like that, the level of the struggle in France has reached a totally different level. You see, there's no, what can they say, you see? You've got all the workers represented, even the ununionized. They struck. They're part of it, you see. They belong to political parties and stuff.
One more
thing. It's a qualitatively different situation.
One more thing.